So I think we're going to have a short Dharma talk today because I wasn't supposed to be sitting here. We're normally a very organized community, but I guess spontaneity still reigns in the Zen world. So I'm going to talk about the Bodhisattva vows, I think, because I gave... You are welcome to come in where you can... you're welcome to stay there if it's... That's good. But feel free. There are seats here, so come on in if you want to. I'm going to talk about the Bodhisattva vows, which we chant at the end. We'll chant at the end of this service. And so let me just begin by reading these. Beings are numberless, vowing to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible, vowing to extinguish them. Dharma gates are boundless, vowing to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, vowing to become it. So the first thing one should think when reading this is, no problem. This is going to be easy. One of my favorite things about these vows that I recite again and again here is their utter incomprehensibility. Each one offers us something which can't be done, an infinite task, which then I vow to do. Or not beautifully in our translation, it doesn't say I vow, but just vowing. So I guess one could think that this is something where we're set up where we can never succeed. But since success is impossible, I think of it more as something where we can never fail. And this is the essence of, I think, our Zen practice. When sitting in meditation, there's no way to fail because there's nothing in particular that we're trying to attain. And having an opportunity to enter a situation where failure is impossible is very different than the way I normally live. I spend a lot of time trying to get things done, and I spend a lot of time feeling rather frantic getting from here to there. So having a little time to be put in the position where failure is impossible is a very tender place to put myself. And I believe that's what this practice asks us to do again and again. So beings are numberless, vowing to free them. Beings, this is something that has been continually confounding to me in this practice. What does it mean? We're always talking about beings around here. And what are those? Really? Does that include you? I think so. Does it include me? I hope so. Does it include animals? Perhaps. Plants, buildings, apples and ants. So, this is an opportunity to include everything into what comes under the purview of our compassion. And beings, technically, I think in this circumstance, refers to things which are, which have the nature of being, so to be, things which are. And in a practical sense, in terms of Zen practice, I think this generally refers to things which are in our consciousness right now. Because this is the only place where being can really be identified or touched. So like right now, what is in your consciousness? You have some visual field. Maybe you're looking at me. I certainly hope so. Good gracious. You have some things in your field of hearing, like the sound of my voice and the sound of cars or perhaps planes. So you have many sensations. You maybe have thoughts going, like, gosh, I wish Lee was here to give this talk. So you have thoughts coming through, all these things that are things that are being. And they're numberless, in my experience, particularly thoughts. Having done a lot of sitting meditation, I found that thoughts are definitely numberless. They just keep coming, arising, things coming into being over and over. So what is this vow to free them? Sometimes this is translated as save them. Around here, I think people think that sounds awfully religious. And so they don't like that. So we have free in our translation. I think I was listening to Reb Anderson give a talk recently, and it informed my idea of what this freeing of beings entails, which is to say, to let them be present to them without attaching to them. That simple. So not freeing them by doing something to them, but merely by neither pushing them away nor holding on to them. So basically treating them in a way other than the way that the first teaching of the Buddha says we treat everything, which is with attachment and craving. So almost everything that comes into our consciousness, we very rapidly and subtly, usually unawares, either decide we like it and we want it and we have a little clinging to it, or we don't like it and we don't want it and we have a little pushing away. And this this freedom that I vow to offer up is one of just letting go of either the holding or the pushing away. So, and if you look at our practice, I think you can see, if you look at our basic Zazen practice of just being with things as they arise, without rejecting them, but without holding on to them, this is all this is. And so this vow offers us the intention. It offers the opportunity to bring into our heart the intention to do this with every experience, with every being, with everything that enters our consciousness over and over again, to just be with it with an open heart without pushing it away. No problem. Dan, is there a clock near you? Oh, or maybe Marty could give me his. That would be good, because I said this would be short, and then I realized I'm talking, which is rarely short. I think that's probably why Zen practice is so good for me, because I really have to shut up. So I can say from experience that relating to things in this way, as we say, this temple is called Living in Vow. The Japanese name for this temple, Ganshoji, means Living in Vow Temple. So coming here and living in this vow to just be with things as they are, without holding, without pushing away, and in this way, living the vow to free all beings, is really has really provided a lot of opportunities for me to be a lot happier than I had been before I got here. In a simple way, not in that I've acquired anything that I wanted, but just in that I was comfortable with what was there. Delusions are inexhaustible, vowing to extinguish them. Well, good gracious. I definitely have learned that I have plenty of delusions.
They do seem to be inexhaustible.
The basic delusion, I think, in this tradition, this is an unprepared talk I'm giving you, is basically the delusion that there is a separation between myself and everything else. So the basic delusion that I'm not just living in a state of total interdependence with everything else in every moment, which I don't usually recognize, or maybe I've never recognized, I don't even know. But generally speaking, there's a lot of me trying to get something out of this or figure out what this is. And so this delusion, but I guess perhaps this line refers to the fact that that delusion arises just again and again and again and again. Anytime I even think I get close to being beyond this delusion, I immediately think, ooh, I think maybe I'm getting beyond that delusion. So, inexhaustible. But maybe they should have said delusions are inexhaustible and exhausting. Vowing to extinguish them. I'm not going to talk about that very much because I don't think I know what it's about. Except for that, coming back to the first vow, just by being with things, that lack of a sense of my connectedness to you or to the activity I've involved in is diminished. I can't say it's extinguished in my experience. Maybe it is extinguished, and I don't know. Or maybe not. Whatever. But I can say experientially it is diminished, and I feel closer. I feel much closer to the people in my life than I did before I started living in this vow. And I feel much closer to the activities of my life. I feel much more intimate with the experience of my own life through this practice. Dharma gates are boundless, vowing to enter them. Dharma gates. I don't have a technical definition, but I guess I generally think of these as this moment is an entranceway, and I don't want to go in there. This Dharma gates are boundless. Dharma gate is a gate. As you enter that gate, everything is there. They're boundless, as in, just like these other vows, Dharma gates are arising again and again and again, boundlessly, over and over. Every instant an opportunity, a Dharma gate here. And that Dharma gate itself is everything. That Dharma gate is the manifestation of that total interdependence of everything. But I don't usually see the moments of my life like that. I see them as, how soon am I going to be out of work? You know, this is the way I relate to life a lot. And yet, I could see that moment as an opportunity to step into my aversion and really touch the experience I'm having and just be open to it. So boundless. So the whole... Didn't someone recently put out a book around here called Each Moment is the Universe? Well, I think the author was named Katagiri Roshi and the editor was named... Andrea, is she here? whoa, do I love the title of that book. Each Moment is the Universe. This is the truth that this Dharma gates are boundless is referring to. That each moment is everything, including the fact that we think it isn't everything. And so... I have the opportunity, I make this vow to enter these moments in that way. And I don't even really know what that means. And yet I make this vow over and over again, and something is happening where my sense of, my connectedness to everything else is continually deepening. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, vowing to become it.
unsurpassable. Boy, that sounds like we've got the one true way there, doesn't it? Danger. Someone may have the one true way. I don't have the one true way. I don't want the one true way. I love having a way. I love the way that we have here. In what way is Buddha's way unsurpassable? Because this vow is meaningful to me. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. Because the Buddha's realization, he said at the moment of his enlightenment in the old stories, I alone with all beings realize the way. This enlightenment, as I understand it, is an enlightenment which is merely a lack of exclusion of anything. Everything that could be or has been is included. Because, as it is described, the separation between the person, Siddhartha Gautama, and the experiences he was having, and everything within that realm of experience was demolished. There was no separation, so nothing was excluded. So, how can one surpass something which includes everything? That includes, how to put it? It includes things that are not included, because they exist by being not included. Oh, now we have the problem of Zen. Well, I won't go any further into that. But it's not unsurpassable in that it is, to me, when I read this, I don't think unsurpassable in that it is better than anyone else's, or even that it is beyond what other people have done, but it's unsurpassable in that all it is being with what is, with no separation. So nothing is excluded. And in that state, nothing can be surpassed. But I don't know a whole lot about this experientially, so I should be careful. Vowing to become it. Well, why not? It sounds like a pretty nice way to live. Vowing to become it is valuable in this tradition because this is not a tradition in which there is a deity who is beyond you. You know, this is something that we do. Zen is something that we do. Or perhaps it's something that we are, or that does us. I don't know. But it is not something that is outside of us, that is going to do something to us. It's just something we engage in. It's something I engage in as well as I can sometimes. I make this commitment. I say these vows. I say these vows on Sundays, and I say them sometimes on Tuesdays, and every once in a while I say them alone. You know, I say them when we're here on those days. And somehow they support my intention to come here and meditate, which needs some support sometimes, because sometimes the cushion looks very mean and scary or boring. I'm the only one who's ever saw that cushion and thought, boring, I'm sure. And yet I keep sitting down, and my sense of intimacy with the people that I know and with the experience of my life and with myself and with the animals that I see and the trees deepens. This is happening, and I am all for it. So, what a funny thing to be sitting in this chair like this. What a surprise. I think I'm not going to say anything more, and we'll see if we would like to have anyone else would like to say anything about this. So, thank you very much.
I'll say this in defense of the last Bodhisattva vow, that unsurpassable doesn't mean that something can't be just as good. it just means they can't be surpassed. As Tim Spahn was saying, I have an idea where it comes from in Zen, that there are many paths up the mountain that at the top they all gaze at the same right point. So I never thought of that this being the one true way. But it just meant, you know, I look at it objectively and say, yeah, I don't think there's anything any better than this, which is why I'm here. And your talk dovetailed very nicely with Rosemary's talk on living in battle, I thought. And as you were talking about, especially the all beings, I was thinking of how Shanti David was talking. Thanks to people who've been annoying to him, you know, for helping him in battle. And I thought, you know, that's how I live in battle, is I come across disagreeable circumstances and people, and it forces me, challenges me, to say, am I true to the vow? Am I going to resist this, and be antagonistic, and defensive, and so forth? Am I going to allow myself to be injured? And so, if I were just comfortable and everything went fine, I'd probably pretty darn loud while I'm losing in my practice anyway. But it would be non-existent. It's the difficult times that make me remember the vow with the all beings, and to become the practice. And if it wasn't for that, if everything was smooth, I wouldn't have a practice. And I remind myself of the difficult times.
Very good. I feel ya.
question in the intro to Zazen, though, it I thought interesting, and we were around compassion in this practice, and we don't do say that the metta meditation of the Vipassanas, of the time we're say maybe Tibetan, but yet I think people who have undertaken a serious practice do recognize compassion. Could you speak to your experience with that, or others here? You know, kind of open up about compassion and Zen.
Well, I'll say something, and then maybe that's a fun topic. So, compassion and Zen. Well, you know, really Zen is about getting hit with sticks and having your teacher yell at you. Sorry, that's not true. Well, certainly, just in the thinking of these vows and compassion, as I do this practice, it's like compassion naturally awakens out of a sense of connectedness. So there are things, I do practice Tonglen sometimes, and I do metta practice, which I guess is supposed to promote loving kindness, and I'll talk about compassion, you know what I mean? So compassion is something that is like a verbal component of my practice, but it also just naturally arises as you relate to experience with a sense of not pushing away and not holding on. Because when I relate to people, I feel closer to them because I'm not overlaying, I'm able to hear them. You know, by practicing hearing myself, my own consciousness in Zazen, when someone talks to me, I hear them more clearly. And that's compassion arises out of that true connection. Normally, without this practice, a lot of times I'm thinking of relationships just in terms of figuring out what's going on. There's all this overlay of my own stuff. And this enables that to fall away a little bit. So I'd love to hear more things about that.
Ben, I'm reminded of Rev Anderson's talk, and he was saying that if we find that we can't feel loving toward other people, and we resent that, we hate that in ourselves, that we allow that to become the object of our compassion. So that nothing is outside the reach of compassion, even if it's our own inability to live in vow. That becomes what we become compassionate about. Which then is like wide open, right? You can't fail.
And I think, coming back to our basic practice, I love that part of his talk, by the way. And it's like, by doing Zazen, we are more intimate with our own consciousness. So you see, by doing this, you will see your resentment come up. So instead of just operating out of the resentment unconsciously and judging and figuring out why the person is wrong, we're thrust into the position of seeing our own resentment. And this asks us, they're numberless. That's the Dharma gate. Once that is dominating the view of your consciousness, enter that with compassion.
I apologize to people who are in the Yoga Char study group because I'm going to repeat myself here. I had a good fortune to work for a bipolar boss twice in my life, the same person. First before I started practice of Zen, and then afterwards. And she was when she was in her bad mood, she was very disagreeable. The slightest things would just blow up. And of course, she would blow up and you'd be defensive and you'd be scared and so forth. And that was the before. And then afterwards, she had one of those episodes where she blew up over some trivial event. And I turned around in my chair and the desk was here. And there was nothing between me and her. And I just focused on the thing she was saying about. And I said, you know, what is it that you'd like me to do? And I said very calmly, and she was taken aback because she was, you know, she was all prepared. You know, she had this need inside to be, I don't know, to be aggressive, and was expecting a response in return. And because I just kind of cut right through that, even though it wasn't the underlying cause of the thing, I focused on it. Like, I'm here for you, Phyllis. You know, what is it you want me to do? And she was, I mean, she actually, and you can see that there's a physical. Like move back slightly, and a surprised look on her face. Just do this, and it was before and after. And so I can't. It wasn't a conscious. It was reflexive, and it's probably the high point of my practice. I can't swear that if it happened now, I would. Well, what are you talking about? You know? But it's that moment. It was reflexive. It was just, you know, there was no me in her. There was no. I wasn't attaching to the antagonism. It was just, I heard you say you needed something. What is it I can do? And the entire situation
changed, and I think for one moment she was free. Mm. And I should, before I, so you don't think I'm bragging? Thanks, Zen. Go Zen. No. So, in the same being thing, talking about, Thich Nhat Hanh often brings in minerals too. So in the vow to save, you know, human beings, animals, plants, he always includes minerals because he makes the connection that, you know, if you do mining or like logging, whatever, you will be basically destroying life.
Mm-hmm.
So he connects up things. So in some sense, non-sentient, sentient, doesn't matter.
Mm.
Because they are connected, you know, in a way.
I like the way that you said it to things that are being sentient, intentioned, take care of everything.
Mm.
No matter if it's this or if it's a rabbit, you know, how can you say that that one is, you know, more being than the other?
I think my son is more being than everything else, but I'll take care of everything else after that.
Whenever I'm thinking of the Bodhisattva vows, which I do with frequency, that was one of the things that most strongly attracted me to Buddhism when I first read them. Almost every time I'm struck by the fact the first one seems to deal with, if I take them very literally, it seems to do with my ability to help beings. How can I feed them? The second one always seems to be with, how can I deal with delusion being my own? How do I deal with my own beings? And somehow there's a connection between the two of them. Interdependency, certainly, but I remember something you actually told me years ago about, I don't know what you were quoting, but to free one person is to free the world entire, even if that person is yourself. But that's amazing, actually, because there's a perfect overlay between to free someone, because of interdependence, is to free everything, and that person can be you. And I also think of this as, you know, the Theravadan emphasis on the arhat who frees himself, and the Mahayana emphasis on the Bodhisattva who, you know, saves everybody first. There's this perfect intersection there between what there will be no difference. That when I am free, everybody is free. Everybody is free. And I don't know if you have anything else to add to it. I always think of that. I always think of that as sort of somehow woven in there because of my own history with these vows, and with you, I think, because of saving. You know, to save one person is to save everything. And that can be you as well. And that there's actually no selfishness, as we normally think of it.
Mm.
But that's an act of selflessness.
Mm.
Of complete devotion. So, I don't have anything else.
I hear ya. Thanks. Thank you. I gave a similar talk just a few weeks ago, so I've had less terror. The Dharma Gate of Terror. I think I would like to just talk about what you were saying, Marty, just a little bit, which is that although I'm very naturally selfish, just as a human is, not like I'm way more selfish than you or anything, but I mean I'm very oriented towards myself, and this practice helps me to sort of shed some of that. One way that I am selfish is in that trying to take care of other people, because I feel like that will make me into a good person, which is kind of what the psychological basis for the need for me to recognize that I need to take care of myself. Certainly my practice, my Zen practice, includes eating well, sleeping well, exercising, making sure I talk to my friends. For some people, maybe that's easy or obvious, but I had to learn it. So, you know, just these basic things of taking care of this is good. Hopefully I don't need to take care of myself by acquiring vast quantities of material items and so forth. Anyone else?
This was actually very powerful for me when I first started coming here. That first line was something that bothered me so much, to free all beings. And, well, I thought it was lovely in the beginning, and then I was driving my car away from Sunday Dharma Talk, and it actually made me cry, because I just thought, it's too much. It's too much. How could I ever do that? Like, Pamela, what are you doing? You're trying to simplify your life. this was really important for me, what you said about it. It's the piece about not grasping and not pushing away, and that frees the being. That's very powerful for me. I'm going to have to sit with that for a while. Thank you.
Thank you.
You have to simplify your life to let the infinite in.
Well, I hope that I have the opportunity to let the infinite in with all of you. I love the talking aspect of our practice, but I really love the sitting quietly aspect. So I hope to have the opportunity to sit quietly with all of you in the future. And I think maybe we should wrap up? Yeah. Let's do that.